And this is about Trotsky's Revolution Betrayed, chapter 6, which is titled The Growth of Inequality and Social Antagonisms. And we're doing it all in one go, I think, because it doesn't contain any major theoretical innovations, and it's more an elaboration and concretization of those theoretical insights that were addressed in previous chapters. Though you can really deal with it in one go as it has a single theme, which is the as in the title, the growth of inequality and social antagonisms. And first of all, it should be said that this analysis does not imply that the Soviet bureaucracy is or was a new stable ruling class with a characteristic role in production. All the material in this chapter flows from a different premise. The contradiction between the existence of socialized property relations in a worker's state and the backwardness of the country. And this has, as previous, it had, I should say, as previously explained, led to the growth of the bureaucracy as an expression of that contradiction. Of the fact that the backwardness of the country meant that economic life required a degree of inequality in distribution and reward to spur the development of the productive forces to the extent that the provision of a decent standard of life to the bulk of the population could even begin to become possible. Marx elaborated this concept in his document, the Critique of the Gotha Program, that a lack of development of the productive forces under even what he called the lowest stage of communism, the lower stage of communism, i.e., socialism, requires a degree of inequality. And the watchword of the ethos that he put forward of that phase of communism, i.e., socialism, would be from each according to his ability, to each according to his work. And that kind of inequality is really a necessary part of the, it's a necessary precondition of the further economic and cultural development need to develop from socialism to the higher stage of communism, which is actual communism. Whereas, as I think Marx said, that we cross the horizon of bourgeois right to the point that inequality withers away, and the watchword of society becomes the from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. But for Marx, just to recap on that, the existence of such equality under what he called the lower phase, i.e., socialism, required the apparatus to administer it. And I think this was it was drawn out by Lenin in State and Revolution as a kind of bourgeois state apparatus, or at least a shadow of one, without the bourgeoisie. But I mean, the point Trotsky is making is that how much more necessary is such an apparatus when the society that expropriated capitalism is qualitatively more backward, materially and economically, than the advanced capitalist powers that surround it? And that was the situation of the Soviet Union. That situation threatened its existence, threatened the existence of the workers' state, both militarily and economically, but particularly with the cheaper commodities that could be produced by the capitalist world that surrounded it. And that's the starting point, really, of the bureaucracy. It arose as a means to manage that necessary inequality. But the danger in such circumstances is that the bureaucracy can become powerful enough to seize power on its own account and to expropriate the proletariat politically, which is basically the social content of what Trotsky called Thermidor. We discussed it at some length in the previous chapter. Trotsky pointed out in such conditions, the growth of the productive forces from such a low level far from reducing inequality, was likely to increase it, at least at first, because as the productive forces developed to the point that they could give a decent standard of living to a minority, but not to the point that it could give the same to the overwhelming majority of the working class. And that is more or less what he analyzes here. He notes the sequence of changes of Soviet economic policy, thus, and I'll quote him at some, well, a little bit anyway. It says, he quote, quoting him, he says, after starting out with so-called socialist distribution, the Soviet FAR found itself obliged in 1921 to return to the market. The extreme stretching of material means in the epoch of the 5-year plan again led to state distribution. That is, a repetition of the experiment of military communism on a higher basis. This basis, too, proved inadequate. In the year 1935, the system of planned distribution again gave way to trade. Thus, a second time, it is made evident that the practical methods of distribution depend more on the level of technique and the existing material resources than even upon forms of property. So this turn back to the market was a reflection of the fact that the Soviet economy was simply too impoverished to be able to guarantee the masses a decent standard of life and a fundamental equality. And this is what happened to the USSR in the 1930s. He goes through this. He says the raising of the productivity of labour, in particular through piecework payment, promises in the future an increase in the mass of commodities, a lowering of prices, and a consequent rise in the standard of living of the population. But that's only one aspect of the matter, an aspect that's already been observed, has also been observed under capitalism in its flourishing epoch. Social phenomena and processes must, however, be taken in their connections and interactions. A raising of the productivity of labour on the basis of commodity circulation means at the same time a growth of inequality. The rise in prosperity of the commanding strata is beginning to exceed by far the rise in the standard of living of the masses. Along with an increase of state wealth goes a process of new social differentiation. According to the conditions of its daily life, Soviet society is already divided into a secure and privileged minority and a majority getting along in want. At its extremes, moreover, this inequality assumes the character of flagrant contrast. Products designed for broad circulation are, as a rule, in spite of their high prices, of low quality, and the farther from the centres, the more difficult to obtain. Not only speculation, but the downright theft of objects of consumption assumes in these circumstances a mass character. And while up to yesterday, these acts supplemented the planned distribution, they now serve as a corrective to Soviet trade. Now, I mean, that's been deduced, and it can be deduced by reading between the lines of the Soviet press itself. And Trotsky did, of course, do that. And he cites a few choice examples in his work. He says, Zhdanov, to the applause of his immediately interested audience, promised that in a year, our active workers will arrive for the conference, not in their present modest Fords, but in limousines. The Soviet technique, insofar as its face is turned towards mankind, directs its efforts primarily to satisfying the high-class demands of a chosen minority. The streetcars, where they exist at all, are, as before, filled to suffocation. No. He goes on. He says, when the People's Commissar of Food Industries, Mikoyan, boasts that the lowest kind of confections are rapidly being crowded out of production by the highest, and that, quote, our women are demanding fine perfumes, this only means that industry, with the transfer to money circulation, is accommodating itself to the better qualified consumer. Such are the laws of the market, in which by moaning the last place is occupied by the highly placed wives. Together with this, it becomes known that 68 cooperative shops out of 95 investigated in the Ukraine in 1934 had no confections at all, and that demand for pastries was only 15 to 20% satisfied, and this with a very low quality of goods. The factories are working, complains Izvestia, without regard to the demands of the consumer. But naturally, if the consumer is not one who's able to stand up for himself. And that manifests itself in the working class and among the collectivized peasantry in different ways that are both inimical to socialist development. I mean, he sort of talks about the working class and the peasantry as sort of separately. But first of all, talking about the working class, within this growing working class, we saw the feverish growth of a labour aristocracy in a manner that could almost be called a caricature of what was going on with the labour aristocracy in the imperialist countries. So he writes. He says, it's indubitable that the situation of the upper layer of the workers, especially the so-called Stakhanovists, has risen considerably during the last year. The press is not without foundation in eagerly listing the number of suits, shoes, gramophones, bicycles, or jars of conserves that this or that dedicated worker has bought himself. Incidentally, it becomes clear how little these benefits are accessible to the rank and file worker. And again, he says, but that's not enough for the bureaucracy. They literally shower privileges on the Stakhanovists. They give them new apartments or repair their old ones. They send them out of terms to rest houses and sanatoriums. They send free teachers and physicians to their houses. They give them free tickets to the moving pictures. In some places, they even cut their hair and shave them free and out of turn. Many of these privileges seem to be deliberately calculated to injure and insult the average worker. And he notes that he notes that the best of the Stakhanovists, those who are really impelled by socialist motives, are not happy in their privileges, but irked by them. And no wonder. Their individual enjoyment of all kinds of material goods on a background of general scarcity surrounds them with a ring of envy and ill will and poisons their existence. Relations of this kind are farther from socialist morals than the relations of the workers of a capitalist factory, joined together as they are in a struggle against exploitation. And Trotsky contrasts this with the conditions of the mass of the workers in the USSR at the time. He writes that the wages of unskilled workers are 1,200 to 1,500 rubles a year, and even less, which under Soviet prices means a regime of destitution. Living conditions, the most reliable indicator of the material and cultural level, are extremely bad, often unbearable. The overwhelming majority of the workers huddle in common dwellings, which in equipment and upkeep are considerably worse than barracks. As a result of these flagrant differences in wages, doubled by arbitrary privileges, the bureaucracy has managed to introduce sharp antagonisms into the proletariat. Accounts of the Stakhanov movement presented at times the picture of a small civil war. The wrecking and breaking of machines is the favorite method of struggle against the Stakhanov movement, wrote, for example, the organ of the trade unions, which sounds a bit like Luddism to me, in its classic sense. But anyway, going on to the question of the rural economy, he says, likewise in the collective farms in the rural village, Trotsky pointed out the relative contradiction between the collective farm form and state property. And he writes that about collective farms, that they rest upon not state property, but on group property. This is a great step forward by comparison with individual scatteredness. But whether the collective enterprises will lead to socialism depends on a whole series of circumstances, a part lying within the collectives, a part outside them in the general conditions of the Soviet system. and a part, no less a part, finally, no less a part on the world arena. And more to the point is the fact that the formal collectivization of agriculture became, in many cases, a mask for the continuation of individual and backward forms in practice. The question of stock breeding of animals was actually cited, and it was quite indicative. Trotsky writes that while the number of horses continued to decline up to 1935, and only as a result of a series of governmental measures has begun during the last year to rise slightly, the increase of horned cattle during the preceding year had already amounted to 4 million head. The plan for horses was fulfilled in the favourable year 1935 only up to 94%, while in the matter of horned cattle, it was considerably exceeded. The meaning of this data becomes clear in the fact that horses only exist as collective property, whereas cows are already among the personal possessions of the majority of collectivized peasants. As a number of other examples given, including the renting of land from one collective farm to another as a means of those farms that were wealthier, often due to better land in their possession, more advantageous land, having the ability in practice to exploit those who are involved in less prosperous farms. The overall picture is far from characterized by equality. So he writes again, he writes, on the average, the income of each collective farm is about 4,000 rubles. But in relation to the peasants, average figures are even more deceptive than in relation to the workers. It was reported in the Kremlin, for example, that the collective fishermen earned in 1935 twice as much as in 1934, or 19 rubles each. And the applause offered to the last figure showed how considerably it rises above the earnings of the principal mass of the collectives. On the other hand, there are collectives in which the income amounts to 80,000 rubles for each household, not counting either income in money or and kind from individual holdings, or the income in kind from the whole enterprise. In general, the income of every one of these big collective farmers is 10 to 15 times more than the wage of the average worker and the lower grade collectivized peasants. The gradations of income are only in part determined by skill and assiduousness in labour. Both the collectives and the personal allotments of the peasants are of necessity placed in extraordinarily unequal conditions, depending on climate, soil, kinds of crop, and also on position in relation to the towns and industrial centres. The contrast between the city and the village not only was softened during the 5-year plan, but on the contrary, was greatly sharpened as a result of the feverish growth of cities and new industrial regions. The fundamental social contrast in Soviet society inevitably creates derivative conditions among the collectives and within the collectives, chiefly thanks to differential rent. And Trotsky concludes that the bureaucracy is both a product of and an active factor in the deepening of these contradictions. He writes that there's a quote again, the unlimited power of the bureaucracy is a no less forceful instrument of social differentiation. It has in its hand such levers as wages, prices, taxes, budget, and credit. The complete disproportionate income of a series of Central Asiatic cotton collectives depends much more on the correlation of prices established by the government than upon the work of the members of the collectives. The exploitation of certain strata of the population by other strata has not disappeared, but been disguised. And thus, in agriculture, immeasurably more than industry, the low level of production comes into continual conflict with the socialist and even cooperative or collective forms of property. The bureaucracy, which in the last analysis grew out of this contradiction, deepens it in turn. So The final section of the chapter is titled "The Social Physiognomy of the Ruling Stratum," and it contains an estimate of the actual numerical strength and social weight of the bureaucracy. And Trotsky goes through several layers of the Communist Party central bureaucracy, the Communist Party membership and the membership of the youth, the state administration, the apparatus of the republics, the cooperatives, the Stakhanovists, the privileged administrators of the collective farms, etc. And he concludes that, I mean, he totes it up and says, well, all these various, often interpenetrated layers amount to around 25 million people, or 12 to 15% of the population. And they constitute the petty bourgeois bureaucratic caste that has grown up as the revolution developed in isolation. So he goes through it again. He says, well, in its conditions of life, the ruling stratum comprises all gradations from the petty bourgeoisie of the backwoods to the big bourgeoisie of the capitals. To these material conditions correspond habits, interests, and circles of ideas. The present leaders of the Soviet trade unions are not much different in their psychological type from the citrines, the juho, and the greens, i.e., the trade union bureaucrats of capitalist countries, basically. Other phraseology, but the same scornfully patronizing relation to the masses, the same consciousness, astuteness, conscienceless astuteness in second-rate maneuvers, the same conservatism, the same narrowness of horizon, the same hard concern for their own peace, and finally, the same worship for the most trivial forms of bourgeois culture. And he continues, it's difficult to estimate the numbers of the bureaucracy. It's harder still to determine their income. As early as 1927, the left opposition protested that the swollen and privileged administrative apparatus is devouring a very considerable part of the surplus value. In the opposition platform, it was estimated that the trade apparatus alone, quote, devours an enormous share of the national income, more than one tenth of the total production. And after that, the authorities took the necessary measures to make such estimates impossible. But for that very reason, these expenses have not been cut down but have grown. Now, I think that's probably enough to now. I think it makes the point, doesn't it, about the nature of the bureaucracy, its size, its social weight, and where it comes from to a degree, you know. So I'm gonna leave it there. I think that sums up that chapter pretty well, and open it up to discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who wants to speak? Sorry.
Who's little? Is
Go
that
on, Marie.
your little doggy aunt?
No, that's next door.
Oh, is that you, Mark?
Yes, it's next door.
Oh. Right, I'll say a few things since there is nobody in front of me. I think what you said, Ian, in the beginning, to put it in context, was useful with the Gotha program. I must admit, I have to go back to this question of backwardness being so much at the base of inequality. I agree with everything, of course, that you've said, and that is in the text. I think that it was really quite a deplorable state of affair, nevertheless, that there would be so much luxury for the people in at the top, and so much deprivation below, and that they would call that socialist, I think the beginning of socialism or something, which is gross. So it makes me think that perhaps in another time when this happens again, perhaps Marxism will not be erased as much as it was erased, because there have been Soviets and there have been a very large, well, no, not large, but a very capable communist leadership which had a lot of background Marxism, and in the previous revolution, the experience of the previous revolution. And yet, after the Civil War, it seems that that was all destroyed, or very much destroyed. And I would hope that we will remember this, us, the humans, we'll remember this, that in spite of all these objective difficulties, and the bureaucracies which developed through the Communist International in the Communist parties, which, the citrines, the Jouots, the Webs, all these people, they weighed, it weighed back, the world was weighing back against the development of socialist consciousness in the Soviet Union. And I think I've read somewhere that the Webs, are the Webs mentioned? I think the Webs are mentioned in this document. These Webs people, they were in Britain at the origin, at the beginning. A Web is mentioned, isn't it, Ian? Yeah, and then these,
Sydney and Baker Webb.
Yeah, they are mentioned.
yeah, Sydney, that's right. And so, the fact these people, when they visited the Soviet Union in 33, I think it was, they declared that it was a new civilization and the falling of themselves in admiration. And so it goes to show that there was more than one reason for such a difficulty to develop. And then, of course, the most important, perhaps, that we mustn't lose sight of is that for this revolution and what it had elevated of consciousness, for this to win and to persist and to extend, it would have needed other revolutions in the world. But as you can see, it was the opposite thing that happened. And the world weighed, the bourgeois class weighed, and then the bureaucracies, the Stalinist bureaucracies of the rest of the, in the rest of the countries. Sort of self-justifying the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. There was a lack of control. I seem to remember there was a discussion between Lenin and Trotsky on the role of the trade unions. And I know this is not central to this particular document, but the trade unions had lost the independence necessary to actually say we are producing crap. And crap was being produced in every way, including the food, which was not even good enough, even at its mediocre level. And there was not the political space where people could observe what was produced, how it was distributed, and denounce it. I know that you could not denounce anything, but that came from the fact that there was not the organisms where people can speak, like trade unions and organs of control. And so I would imagine that in an occasion when this happens again, regardless of all the problems and backwardness, which still exist in most of the world, we would, the communists who are still alive, haven't been destroyed, would insist that that all matters must be controlled. And so at the last in this document, Trotsky says, freedom from control inevitably entails abuse of office. And he describes, yeah, the malfeasance, which is at the level of money, but which is also at the level of the right that the people at the top who are uncontrolled have to grant funds to the regions, and those of the regions to the locality, and to allocate this as as best for their interests. And so this is another form of plundering on top of all the rest, which is already which Ian mentioned. And then he says it's chiefly the because the whole advance in social well-being is not this upper privileged stratum could continue to function as it did because there was no way to control, no means to control. And then I would say the Communist Party was no longer functioning as a Marxist, but just as an administration. And so I think it's an experience which is which we must keep ourselves in our memory, which we must pass around to others. It's not enough to have discussed this, but it's an experience which must be communicated so that these sort of things should be avoided in the next in the next revolution. Finally, I would like to say a few words about the way I saw this question. I used to think that it was just that bourgeois mentality continues because you can't go from bourgeois mentality to the socialist one without the continuation of the imagination of private property. But obviously this is idealist because this conception of private property doesn't live up in the air. It's based on material conditions. And if the material conditions, there's a shortage and there is not enough for everybody, obviously this leads to people seeking the best for themselves and a scramble. And so it's a complicated thing in which Trotsky says it was still better. It was still the distribution of this earth good in the Soviet Union is incomparably more democratic than it was in Tsarist Russia. So I think we should remember that. Otherwise, we are just going to give up on revolution. Thank you.
Who else wants to speak? Sure.
Yes, I have. Thank you.
Susan is here. Oh, excellent. Right. I didn't notice you actually arrived. Excellent. Excellent.
Oh, good.
Clive had his hand up.
Who had his hand up?
Clive.
Clive. Yeah, Clive, if you want to speak. Yes, you did. Yes. Sorry. You're muted, though, Clive. Yeah.
We can't hear you, Claire.
You're muted.
That's better. Sorry about that. I was going to say thank you to Marie for that excellent explanation of what Ian has been saying. I thought they matched up very well. As Ian's thought was very clear. We all thought was very clear in helping with the clarification of that. And Trotsky was, of course, fantastically clear in making sure that all these things could be understood because his writing is, as ever, lucid and wonderful in its clarity, given all sorts of French allusions, not to mention lobsters and Thermidor and things of that sort that we've mentioned in previous sessions. So I was very happy with that. Thank you very much. And one thing I did wonder about was something which I've completely forgotten. So I'll think of it later. That's all right. Thank you.
Who else wants to speak? Oh,
Diana,
yep.
yeah,
Sorry. Karen would like to speak.
that was a splendid account of organization of wealth and power in post-revolutionary Russia, and it really emphasized how much we need to keep the power in the work hands of the workers.
Okay.
Diana?
Yes, quick question, mainly is how environmentally aware was Trotsky, and how aware was he about the potential pollution and toxicity of luxury products? And how damaging actually artificial fertilizer is to soil. It's probably rather a trivial thing, but I was struck by the women wanting fine perfumes. Perfumes are toxic. People are allergic to them, and it goes on about cars. I mean, who really wants nasty, polluting, noisy cars? I mean, you don't want them because you've got money, only to get about. So, I mean, did he ever question why people would actually want that stuff?
Well, can I just come back on that briefly? I mean, Paul wants to speak. Let Paul speak first.
I wanted to come back on that last point. Yeah, I get what you're saying about the environmental stuff, and I guess we'll find out a bit more later on about what Kroki thought or might have said about the environment. But the point is, when you're going from one system, i.e. capitalism, there's going to be that stage between the transition where, to start with, people are going to want some of the material goods that the people at the top have, kind of thing. What I'm trying to explain really badly is, you have to sort out people's current sort of material living conditions first and foremost, and then once you change your mode of production and the kind of material thing that people need, then you can sort of sort out, you can then deal with. So, well, since we don't have to work 12-hour shifts anymore, we don't need to travel so far to work. Do we need to really travel that far? Or perhaps if the state funded, perhaps the state provided railway network, if that was better, that might be another reason why you might want to travel by rail as opposed to car, using your cars. So what I'm trying to get at is, for the time being, those kind of questions, yeah, today we are much more environmentally aware, but of course you have to deal with what people had to put up with at that particular time. Obviously, once the mode of production has changed, once the revolution has happened, and people on the whole are much better off than the people at the top, then you can start to formulate some of these other questions about, do we really need a car for this when we could use the publicly funded railway, for instance. I hope that goes some way to answering what I'm trying to get at.
Can I just say something on this? I mean, basically, I think that Trotsky is not saying these things are virtues. In fact, very much the opposite. He's talking about the aspirations of the bureaucracy to have a privileged life over the masses, you know. And I think the context is important because you're not talking of, before World War II, and actually in the aftermath of World War I, the Western countries and also Russia were very, very heavily industrialized in the old sort of smokestack factory, huge sort of industrial workplace sense. And a lot of that has been changed or modified in the Western countries today, in the advanced countries. It's moved into places like China and other parts of the world, and the big heavy industries that were dominant in the in Europe and in America have been massively slimmed down, and you have a different situation now. And I think the environmental movements and environmental consciousness, it is there in Marx, it's there to a degree in some aspects of Trotsky's writing and Lenin's writing, but it doesn't play the major role that it does in some of the post-war World War II and discussions about the environment and the implications of many, many decades of industrialization and pollution and things like global warming were very, that was something of the future in those days, global heating or whatever. That was something that barely registered, if at all, in the popular consciousness or even in the scientific consciousness, only to a very limited degree, I think. I think what we were talking about then was the working class in Europe was much, much bigger, much more classically proletarian. And that was true in Russia as well. Except the problem in Russia is that the working class was a minority of the population in an immensely backward country. And that was the driving force of the degeneration of the revolution once it was isolated, So I think it really is a different context. I think obviously the points about the long-term consequences of industrialization and pollution and all this sort of thing is a valid concern, but I don't think it loomed as large as it does today, because capitalist decay was at a rather earlier stage, and some of the problems they were dealing with was, well, we're starting to have to deal with them again, like fascism and genocide and world war, and but that was an immediate concern in the interwar period, and the people were afraid that they're going to be massacred and whatever, and that is happening today again. We're seeing it happen, but there was a whole period of decades after World War II where that seemed to be a remote thing, there's obviously the threat of nuclear war and confrontation between the US and the USSR was an overarching issue, but the idea of armies rampaging around the world and armies across Europe and whatever was a bit of a remote idea. I don't think it's quite so remote today, but I think the context is different and the concerns were different, and people had different consciousness of the of what might happen to them, So I don't know. I mean, I think all the concerns you raise are valid, but I think in that context they probably didn't loom as large in the minds of those who are involved as they do today. That's how I would probably suspect. Diana, you want to come back?
Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I take the point about what Paul was saying. You should use a car if you're, when the transport infrastructure isn't good. But then at that time that Trotsky was talking about, the mass of people didn't have the option of using a car.
No.
Maybe a few of them had the option of using bicycles, but from what he says, even bicycles seem to be a bit of a luxury. But actually, Russia was, and the USSR particularly, and at the time of the revolution, Russia was very environmentally and ecologically advanced in its environment, ecological consciousness. I don't know how much that affected that had an influence of the on the mass of the population who, if they were in destitution, what were their main concern would just be basic survival. But Marx in particular, especially as he got older, a bit later on, was very concerned with environmental issues, and that was I'm not sure how concerned Lenin was, but he certainly supported people within ecological and environmental concerns around the time of the revolution. So I think the extent to which Russia and the USSR was being concerned with the environment is actually underestimated, probably possibly because of the propaganda we're subjected to.
Could I ask a question if nobody else does? I need to find my question. Page 19, sorry. Sorry, folk. And it is something to do. 16, 13. I wonder if somebody knows what this matter is in reference to a figure of half a million for the administration, where administration is carried on and is well known in the manner of the triangle. This is page 9, 13. So it's a question of the triangle, and it was in the little paragraph talking about the administration of the industrial enterprises in the middle of the page. No?
I'm not sure actually. What page is it? Sorry, let me have a look.
Page 13. I hope I've got the same document as you.
You have got the same document, but whether it's the same edition is another question. Let me see if I can find it.
So you must add.
Trouble is,
I've just.
I don't use the page numbers. I just download, I just get the chapter from the Marxist in the archive
That's what
and
I do as well.
gives you the whole chapter, but it doesn't give you the page number
You're right.
unless it's a
Why? I've
PDF version.
just found the triangle bit.
Right.
Just
Can you read?
scrolling through, and I was curious about that as well. Let's see what heading it's under. Oh, God. It's under four, the social physiognomy,
Yeah, it's one
what's
page.
it? I think that's the last section, isn't it? It's quite a way down, about halfway through it.
So it is only just a few paragraphs from the beginning of that chapter.
All right.
It
I've
says
lost it now.
immediate administration of industrial enterprise was concentrated in 33 in the hands of 17,000 directors. This is where it is.
Yeah, I found it. I don't know whether anyone else, but.
Using you, Ian? Oh, you are muted, Ian. You are muted, Ian.
Yeah, I'm looking in the wrong place. Hang on a second.
Yeah, it's number four, and it's soon after the beginning of the physiognomy. Two, three, four, five, six paragraphs from the social
Yeah.
physiognomy. I'm sorry.
It's chapter four, six, the seventh paragraph. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, hello, Suzanne. Nice to hear.
Nice to hear you too.
Yeah.
I think they're really talking. They don't say what's the population of Russia in 1933? Because obviously it's before the war and the loss of the 27 or more million who died in World War II. But how much bigger is it
What's the
than?
population of the USSR?
It
That's a good
says
question, actually.
160 million, it says on I'm looking on Google.
So, well, I thought it was 100, it's 140 million now. So presumably, it's had not only, two world wars, but also the massive death mortality of the 1990s to contend with as well. But it can't always have been hovering around 140 million, can it?
It says 160 here, 168 at the end of 33.
Right, okay, so nearly 170 million. I
Yeah.
don't think under a million, one in 170, is unreasonable for the
Bureaucracy.
necessary t civil service stroke bureaucracy that's needed, is it?
Yeah, there was a lot of, I think it says somewhere there was a lot of duplication because the republics were
Yes, but
repeating the
even
same
so,
the
that,
reasons.
one. When I think of any sort of industrial or other enterprise, one in 20 is nearer sort of what management thinks it ought to be, isn't it?
Let's have a think of Russia.
I mean, they're talking about sort of one in 300 as, or, administration.
My Google says that Russia had 160 million in 1933. Not the Federation, it's just Russia. But that's true. He's talking about the Federation. Trotsky's probably talking about the Federation. Because he talks about the duplication between the republics.
Won't you be talking about the USSR? The Russian Federation is just is Russia plus a small number, much fewer number of the republics than the USSR included.
Yeah, it could
And
be.
Trotsky would have been talking about the USSR, which would have
Absolutely, absolutely.
included all of the republics. It would have
Yeah,
I don't
you're
know. I mean,
population.
Ukraine, Belarus
It includes
are
everything. Yeah.
part of the Russian Federation, but they were part of the USSR.
The whole of Central Asia as well, which is not part of Russia, And Ukraine and Belarus and all the Baltic states, a big chunk of that territory is now not in Russia, not in the Russian Federation. So it's a different thing altogether, really.
Indeed, Trotsky talked about the SSR. He didn't talk about Russia in this document. You're muted, Ian.
Yes, he was talking about the USSR, a different population set, really. That's why it's not so easy to transfer it, I think.
No. So I do not know what to say to Susan.
Well, what I'm saying now is, as of December 2023, in a country like ours of 70 million people, there are half a million full-time civil servants. I'm just saying that Trotsky's a bit unrealistic to think that 170 million people or 160 million people would only need under a million civil servants of some shape or form.
Is that
Is
what
that
he's?
not reasonable?
Well, what he's actually talking about is a privileged layer of the population, though, isn't it? He's not talking about the technical category of civil servants as such, because that's an occupation. The distribution of wealth, etc., among them, can be handled in many different ways. He's talking about a layer of the population that is the social basis of the Stalin regime, which was no longer based on Soviet democracy. It had actually expropriated and done away with the organs of working class rule and substituted itself for those. So he was talking about the social base of that layer. He wasn't necessarily talking about civil servants as a technical category. I mean, that's There are many different ways that could be the administration can be done, and you would need layers of administrators, yes, but would they be a privileged layer of administrators, or would they be a social base for a much more privileged layer of the top administrators that existed in Soviet in Stalinist Russia, not really Soviet Russia, because Soviets had ceased to function, by the sort of mid-20s, really, or even the early 20s, to be honest. It's a different thing, I mean, if you had Soviet democracy, you could have a layer of administrators who would be subordinate and accountable to Soviet to the Soviet democracy, to elected organs of working class power. The problem is that those are disintegrated, and the bureaucratic layer that he's talking about was not accountable to that layer, to that system of administration. So I think we're talking about slightly different things here. That's how I see it anyway.
I'm just saying that I just think Trotsky's complaint about, there is a need for certain jobs in every administration. If he was complaining about the privilege that a particular group is keeping for themselves, that I can understand. If he's ranting about the existence of it, that is not such a good thing, because that's like saying everybody in a hospital can be a, can be a neurosurgeon. It doesn't work like that. We all have to work as a team together.
He's talking, I mean, at the end, he's talking about the social base, or what he's talking about in the first two parts of the chapter. I mean, particularly the growth of the labor aristocracy, which is a classic phenomena that supports a privileged layer. It's sort of like a caricature almost of what goes on in the imperialist world. Likewise, the inequalities in collectivization, that the collectivization became more and more differentiated in practice, and privileged layers, in fact, actually gained some of their wealth at the expense of other layers of the collective, formerly collectivized peasantry. And that growth of privilege was the basis for the growth of an even more privileged layer of administrators. I think you could do again about you can't do without administration, but it's about, economic planning requires administration. Trotsky was very much in favor of economic planning, and been arguing for it against the against
I
the extension.
just don't see any sign in Trotsky that he is looking for want of a better word, democratic, transparent, and fair ways to promote competence and to make people accountable for incompetence. Now, it might be elsewhere, but
It
just, yeah, but just blaming a group of people for the fact that privilege will dissipate its, value, to the greater community doesn't bring us to the survival of, communism and socialism as a productive way. And this is what, surely Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, all of them were about the survival of the Soviet Russia and other communist countries, other revolutions, as being, something that would survive. Yeah, and that's all I'm saying is I'm not always convinced that Trotsky is really interested in building up the resilience that would allow the revolution to thrive and to give people a reason to see the value in it.
Interesting.
Diana wants to speak.
Yes.
The very last paragraph of that chapter, he does reference the need to publish figures, which is making a reference to need for openness. He says, the French will want to dispute our figures. Let them give us others more accurate. Let them persuade the bureaucracy to publish the income and expense book of Soviet society. So he is making, I take that as a reference to a need for more openness. Unless I've misinterpreted him there.
Oh, no, he says, well, he doesn't doubt that it's more democratic than it was. Yes.
But he is asking for the figures to be published. What he complains about is he doesn't know the bureaucracy, that the elite are actually hiding covering up what is actually going on. And he does make a brief reference to the need for more openness. Perhaps it's too brief a reference,
Well,
but
I
he
think
does
so.
refer to that.
Yeah, it's such a short sort of rejoinder. But what I'm talking about is the way in which the bureaucracy can demonstrate its usefulness, but just as importantly, the mechanisms by which other people outside can see what's going on and can see the value of it. Yeah. I mean, if you have an administrator, if you have a bureaucrat, if you have a manager, you want to be sure that that person is actually the best person for the job, or you want to at least be confident that they're not doing harm,
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the only way you can do that is through a system of Soviet democracy and of accountability to the working class, of those officials. And of course, the idea that officials, going back to Lenin and going back to the State and Revolution, he was actually in favor of all officials being paid no more than the wages of an ordinary worker or a skilled worker anyway, And that is what he's talking about, And everybody should get the chance to be an administrator, so nobody becomes a professional administrator, and nobody becomes an eternal administrator or consolidates into an administrative layer that's separate from the rest of the population. And that's we discussed that earlier. There is more stuff in Revolution Betrayed about this. I mean,
My concern is much more to do with you can be a good administrator and people will want you to stay in your job. I think what he doesn't emphasize enough is that what we have to prevent is the nepotism that allows people to who have risen through their own skills and efforts and not just experience, but their demonstrable talent have risen to a certain level of power and influence, who then misuse that advantage to promote their own children, favorites. And that in effect is a form of corruption, which will inevitably lead to the revolution being betrayed.
Paul wants to speak. Sorry, that's Paul
Yeah, I think
speaking.
so.
I don't quite agree with what Susan was saying there, because the whole point of the Soviets, i.e. worker council, which is what they were, and then having people to have rolling positions is precisely a method by which the idea was to prevent that kind of nepotism, if we call it these days. But of course, certain elements of the bureaucracy became more powerful. Trotsky did actually realize this was happening, if you go back to some of the previous chapters that we've already studied, that's why they put forward a left alternative program. And then they all got put in it, and all that goes big. And then the bureaucracy in turn then found that they did actually have to introduce some of the left opposition program, but in a very crude way. So I don't accept your interpretation that Kroki didn't understand what was going on in this particular situation or that situation. He did understand what was going on and paid the price for it at various points in his life. So I don't accept that at all. Thanks.
That's okay.
I would like to say a few things.
Yes, of course, Maria.
Yes, I think Paul is right in pointing to the other things that we have studied, and also to the I would like to point to the like Ian has referred to the democratic program in the trade unions, for example. This is extensive. It's books. Trotsky has written books. And the transitional program, which he wrote just before being assassinated, returns on many of the things that you've just said, Suzanne, where in fact he gives a whole program for avoiding finding oneself in front of people who are ruling over you without any control whatsoever. This is why they assassinated him. It's because of what you say, Suzanne, because of what is bothering you, because he said it, he was exiled, and now he's written this document here from Norway, just at the time of being thrown out from Norway. He's being moved over to Mexico. He had to go to Mexico now, because of what he said in terms of what you raised. And so, and it was much more complete what he said about how people should be given tasks on the basis of their capacity to carry them out. He had led the Red Army, and he knew mightily well how to do this. And this is how they defeated 28 countries which attacked Russia in the Civil War. And so, yeah, I tend to react a little bit like Paul, that he needs looking a little bit more from your part, Suzanne. Just look a little bit more at who Trotsky was and the other things he wrote. This is only just one aspect, a partial aspect of all the things. And then, of course, with Lenin and Trotsky, they led the most advanced democracy that the Soviet democracy never existed before, except in 1905. Briefly, there was a Soviet in 1905, but in 1917, it was Lenin and Trotsky, and then the teams and the people around them and their comrades, who insisted and who gave all the power to the Soviets. And as I mentioned, the Soviet, it was a committee where everybody could go. Everybody can go to the Soviet. There were committees, national, regional, and then there was all sorts of local ones, and they all communicated with each other, and there was a vibrant democratic life for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. After 1917, and then imperialism threw itself at the throat of this new thing, and then tried to strangle it because it was such an example that there were Soviets now. Soviets happened in many other places, including in Latin America. There was a Soviet even in Cuba, you know, and one in Hungary, and you know, and whole world was influenced.
Yeah. Go on, Paul, and then I'll say something. Paul?
Yeah, I wanted to come back in on Murray's last point when he talked about the Soviet, the separate worker committees in local locations and so on. That's the one of the probably that's a defining example of what differentiates a communist society from today's bourgeoisie, so-called representative democracy, isn't it? The people involved in those council meetings, not only were they just in the committee meeting, but they were directly involved in the work that they were doing. That's a stark contrast to what we're used to today, where we go for elections every 4 or 5 years, and then we're expected to believe that that's somehow democracy. But the Soviet system has been done before, and that's the key thing, in my view, that differentiates that from the bourgeoisie world that we currently live in.
I was looking up Diane's point about the Soviet system and science, and I think science in the first 20 years of the Soviet system, so sort of 17 to 37, 39, you're looking at an absolute flowering of Soviet talent, whether it's arts, music, creativity, film, and particularly science. And they made huge strides. And the whole point about it was that it was an unlocking of talent across the board, which allowed both pragmatic and blue sky science to flower. And unfortunately, as and that was recognized in the West, but I think the capitalists in the West and the ruling elites look on this with a huge amount of fear, and the pressure that was put on the Soviet Union, particularly in terms of the threat, tended to make it so that people like Stalin, they fell under the sway of people like Lysenko, simply because they were offering an ideology. They were not interested in theories. They were certainly not going to allow themselves to be accountable for demonstrating the efficacy of their ideas. They simply realized that that they could sell the snake oil. And, ideologues of both sides, right and left, if you like, or capitalism and communism, they all fall for that snake oil because they want to believe. And so, Stalin embracing Lysenko, he'd set himself up for it. But it's also true that the Americans, if you like, fell for Pavlov and this whole idea of the human spirit being entirely malleable. Yes, that you could train people to be like the dogs that obey the whistle. The Americans, if you like, and the West have fallen for, the same thing that I would actually call the sort of the Jesuit mentality. The if you train people to believe something as an early child, they will, they never recover from it. The Soviet real damage was that it challenged the status quo, and the West has relied on the status quo, not really for things to stay the same, but for any form of progress to be strictly controlled so that it only is allowed to progress in a certain area. Whereas I think the Soviet Union and certainly the Chinese Revolution, Cuba, all of these, they want to go their own way. They want to see how things could change. They want to harness the whole of the population to be part of the revolution, not this constant regime change where you're not allowed to be anything new because it might be dangerous, but above all, because it'll change who is in control at the top. And all they want is a game of musical chairs, like we've got with the Tory Party now. This person decides they'll be PM for this week or 6 weeks. That they don't they just use democracy as a it's like an icon to worship. We're not democratic. They rig all of the elections, they rig the candidates, it's all a fixed system. but they can waive the fact that you put an X on a ballot paper and tell you that it's democracy, but it isn't. It's rigged. And the Soviet system was something where people were involved all the time. And that's what I think people regret about, you know, how it's been changed, yes, by the pressure as it has been put under. But it is becoming, you know, the Russian Federation may not be what the communists want it to be, but it is what the majority of people want it to be now. And it will become what it becomes because of being responsive to what the people want, and the people will change it, to become more more communist, more socialist, as it's more successful.
Can I just come back on a couple of things? I mean, I think just in terms of the remark at the very end of Trotsky's this chapter about let them persuade the bureaucracy to publish their income and expenditure and whatever, you know, publish the figures. Well, that is an echo of the transitional program, of course, because Trotsky was for, as a weapon against capitalist secrecy, open the books, let us examine the profit and loss of all the companies who are hiding their economic situation, hiding their, you know, trying to deceive the working class, etc. So it's sort of an echo of that. But I mean, there are lots of things you can say about administrators and who's a good administrator and who isn't, and how you determine who is and who isn't, and whatever. But in the end, it comes down to Soviet democracy. And I think that's what Trotsky is arguing. In not really in this chapter is just one chapter of a whole, a whole work really about, and its conclusion is obviously about Soviet democracy and the need to restore it, because it had gone into decline and had ceased to exist. Because the point about the administrators is not that administrators are bad, but these administrators have been, the concrete things that he was talking about were in existence and accompanying a situation where the administrative caste in itself had become powerful enough to stifle the working class democracy that's supposed to hold it to those standards or that accountability. And that had disappeared. And that's what he's talking. Whether he successfully elaborated the material base of this in a literary form, I'm not sure. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he could have said more. But that's what he's really talking about: is that social phenomena, what comprised it, and its consequences concretely for workers' democracy, and the fact that it had actually seized control off the conscious working class, and that the Soviets had ceased to be operative. Now, you know, I think there are other chapters about this in later on. I know for a fact there are. You're about halfway through the book, as far as I can see. But there's quite a lot more to cover, you know, and there is a lot of material about that, which probably might actually come up with an interesting discussion in itself, you know. But I would just be a bit patient on this, because there is a lot more to study, you know. That's all I would say.
I mean, I think, you know, one of the refreshing things about the Soviet Union is there, as you know, Dickens talks about grad grind and the fact that the capitalist system demands that education should be restricted to you only get to learn what you need to know, whereas the Soviet Union flagrantly said anybody should be free to study what they want to study, and they should be free to be educated in what they want to be, you know, that their access to arts and sciences and other all forms of learning should be, determined by their interest, not by their place there in society or their monetary value. There is a bit of an element of the hair shirt phenomenon, which I think is what sometimes people rail against, is, you talked about perfume. It's the why shouldn't working class people like beautiful things? It's just that it's not that everybody can't have them. It's that we can't have, everybody can't have what other people don't have. Yeah. That you can't have, that if you can't all have a Fabergé egg because they just take so much time and skill and money to do it. But that doesn't mean you can't paint and decorate your own eggs and show that you are talented. I mean, the thing that I was fascinated with Stalin is how willing he was to ensure that people got access to land, could build their houses, could invest in their own property. And it wasn't about becoming property owning classes, it was about more about independence. And Trotsky is all about, to me, he's all about consensus and working together. Yes. But there feels like there's less independence and people surviving because they are doing it for themselves. And I don't know whether that's just because the two were set so much up against each other during the 20s and 30s. Anyway, sorry, Paul, you had put
Oh,
your
you
hand
want to
up and
speak, yeah.
carried on.
Well, sorry to be a bit literal on this, but the point about the perfume thing that was mentioned in the chapter wasn't that Trotsky wasn't complaining that people couldn't have these things. He wasn't saying that. What he was saying was that only the upper layers of the bureaucracy were benefiting from that. That's the point. And the point was, he was saying that even despite the revolution and the achievements thus far, there were still huge layers of poverty where people weren't even getting the basics. Yes, but the layers of the upper end of the bureaucracy were still managing to get all their luxury products. And that's what Kotke was rallying against. It wasn't that he wasn't saying that people per se couldn't be entitled to these things, but at that particular point in time, those luxury items were the masses were excluded from that, even though the working classes made those products. But the majority of the working class, even at that point, was not getting, they were not able to get those products. But the people at the top of the bureaucracy were getting those products. That's what Kropsky was saying about luxury items. But yeah, thank you.
I mean, I think the problem with luxury items is for some people, they want them simply because they are not easy to
Forget.
get hold of. In other words, it's their rarity
Yeah.
value, not whether or not they like them, and you get that with people, But I would agree with you, Diane. I think it's more about if people have access to water and sufficient hot water, then they don't need vast amounts of perfume. Whole point about the perfume industry is it was about the fashion. It's about the fashionableness of it, and having things that other people don't have, so that they can emphasize their that they're different, that they're special, that they are better than other people. No? You know, it wouldn't matter if you were, if most, you know, most perfumes start out as flowers. It's the, you know, med the making of perfumes is a skill. I think you're probably right. Trotsky is talking about it as a, but it's also the element of the industry itself. How do you judge an industry? You know, if you look at the sheer amount of labor that goes into, you know, how many rose petals you have to harvest in order to be able to make attar of roses, it's a shockingly intensive, backbreaking job. No?
I think Clive wants
But
to
it's
speak.
something nice and horrible. Yeah, go on, sorry.
Does Clive want to speak? You're muted now.
I'm now, okay, yes. I was just going to make a very brief contribution, now I'm allowed to, which is that belief, in the words of Mark Twain, is the conviction that anything you say is not true.
What does that
Yeah, follow that.
Yes, I think it. To be honest, I think
Oh,
belief.
Claude, he said that again. I didn't quite catch
Didn't
the
quite
end
catch
of
that
that. Belief is saying that you, what you're saying is not true. It's from Mark
how did I
Twain.
hear that? It's, isn't it more that faith is that which you believe without evidence? And
That's the thing,
sometimes it
yes.
is, yeah, and sometimes it is the things
Mm-hmm.
that you continue to believe in the face of evidence to the opposite. Yeah. But yes, there is a real problem. You can't have faith and evidence because if you had proof of it, you wouldn't need to believe it, would you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Proof is believing what you know ain't true.
Place here, yeah. Well, yeah.
Otherwise known as modern monetary theory, isn't it?
I don't know about
He
that.
says, poking up.
We could have a debate about that, actually, at some point. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Is there anybody else who wants to speak on this subject?
No, just to say thank you, and yeah.
We could have a point on anything else anybody wants to discuss, if that's all right. But should we conclude the actual, the actual point on the educational now, if everybody's okay with that, yeah? And go, I'll just stop the recording.